Now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, but before we get to today's theme, I want to remind you to take the poll that is up on my website. I ask a simple yes-no question. The question is this: will the California primary be important in deciding the GOP presidential candidate for 2012? And your answers are yes, it will be important, or no, it will already be decided by the time the candidates come here to California. Cast your vote, and I'll announce the results of the poll on Thursday's show. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is challenging conventional wisdom. Each of my guests is presenting ideas to challenge the conventional wisdom in their area of expertise. My next guest is a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. We'll examine his thesis for using economic relations to build more peaceful, prosperous, and secure world from his latest book, The Peacekeeping Economy. And if you have questions or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Lloyd Dumas is a professor of political economy, economics, and public policy in the School of Economics, Policy, and Policy Science at the University of Dallas, at University of Texas at Dallas. He's an expert in many areas, including economics of peace and the macroeconomics of military spending. Dr. Dumas has published more than 120 works, and he's been quoted as an authority by Time, Business Week, Science Magazine, Der Spiegel, Chicago Tribune, and the list goes on and on and on. Lloyd Dumas was born in Yonkers, New York. He received his undergraduate degree and his graduate degree from Columbia University. He received a BA in mathematics, an MS in industrial engineering, and a PhD in economics. He served on the board of SANE, which is the Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, and Economists for Peace and Security. Joining us from the Dallas area, welcome back to the show, Lloyd. How are you today?
Nice to be with you again, Bill. I'm just fine.
Well, glad to have you back. You're a thought leader, and this book really does challenge conventional wisdom. Now, I need to remind you from the last time, Ventura County is the home to a military base, Naval Station Ventura County. So the idea of military strength is virtually synonymous with the security, and it's deeply, deeply entrenched in our area here. You assert, however, in the book that economic relationships can offer a far more effective and far less costly means of maintaining security. How so?
Well, you have to understand that the idea of military strength being synonymous with security is very widespread, but it's not correct. In fact, primarily, security has always been a matter of relationships. For instance, during the whole of the Cold War, the United States spent trillions of dollars and lots of time and energy trying to figure out how to prevent an attack, nuclear attack on the U.S. from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't spend 10 minutes or $10 worrying about France or Britain attacking us. Either one could have done horrendous damage with their nuclear weapons to the U.S. The difference is pretty obvious. We had a very hostile relationship with Russia, and we have had a much more friendly relationship with Britain or France. And similarly, today we worry a lot about Iran getting nuclear weapons, but we're not very worried about Israel's nuclear arsenal. So it is a matter of what kind of relationships you have with other countries, primarily. Now, I'm not saying that military force is not important or not useful. It certainly is part of security. But I think by relying more heavily on economic relationships that are balanced and mutually beneficial, we can create a lot of security without having to resort to military threats.
Well, I'm a liberal when it comes to free trade, so I like what you have to say, but I want to come back to the U.S. versus the USSR back in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, and challenge you a little bit here, because there is a classic example, because we're antagonistic against one another, where we got into that spiraling arms race where we were developing different types of nuclear weapons and delivery systems, and that was in essence what kept us mutually deterred, because neither one wanted to be the first to pull the trigger. So it does matter your perspective. I see that, but I've also seen these arms races in my lifetime, the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, get to staggering proportions. And we felt, at least in the 50s and the 60s, that that was important and it was a deterrent, and that's what kept us safe.
But you'll notice that when the Cold War ended and the relationship between the United States and Russia became much more positive, we started worrying a lot less about an attack from the Russians, because there was much less likelihood of an attack. As the relationship warmed up, the threat from the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, faded. And that's what I'm saying. Not that you don't ever need military strength for deterrence purposes or for other purposes, but that you can do most of the heavy lifting with better economic relationships. But they have to be the right kind of relationships. They have to be balanced and mutually beneficial. That's very important. Exploitative relationships in which the flow of benefit is mainly in one direction create hostility and conflict. They don't reduce it. And you can see that by going back to the history of the United States, actually. The American Revolution was largely fought because of the exploitative trade relations between the United States and Britain, the colonies in Britain, actually, at the time. That made a huge amount of difference. And also, there was no balance in the decision power in the relationships either, so that we were very upset about that, too. The slogan in the American Revolution was not no taxation. It was no taxation without representation. We wanted to have a say on what went on in our relationship with Britain. So if you have balanced relationships, which are balanced in terms of benefit and balanced in terms of decision power, they tend to reduce the threat of conflict erupting into war, whereas relationships which are exploitative and primarily in one direction tend to increase hostility and can drive you into a situation of war.
My guest is Lloyd Dumas, author of the book, The Peacekeeping Economy, Using Economic Relations to Build a More Peaceful, Prosperous, and Secure World. So, Lloyd, let me challenge you a little bit and at least talk about your thesis in some more detail by looking at relationships between certain countries. And I'm going to start with the United States versus China right now. There we have trade relations going both ways, but we also have the Sixth Fleet in the South China Sea conducting military exercises there on a fairly frequent basis as well as a show of U.S. force. And, of course, China just recently released photographs of its first aircraft carrier that it has floating around the South China Sea as well. So talk to us about the trade relationships between the United States and China and how they fit into your thesis.
Actually, it's a very important issue that you raised because we're on the cusp of going one direction or going in another. We have economic relationships with China which are very important to both countries. And if we continue to emphasize that end of our connection with each other, we won't need to be as worried about a military forces. China is building up its military forces because its economic strength has increased, and that has allowed it to. And so is following a pattern that many nations have followed in the past to their detriment. This is a part of my argument that we haven't yet talked about, but high levels of military spending, as in the arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, create negative economic effects. They damage the economy. And I can explain in a moment why that's true. But what I'm saying is that if China decides to take the path of military competition with the United States, it will cost both countries a huge amount of resources, do a lot of damage to the Chinese economy as well as to the U.S. economy. That won't be in anybody's interest. It's much better to build secure relationships around balanced economic relations.
All right, let's talk about that point, Lloyd, if we can, in a little bit more detail. High military spending ruins a country. Well, we certainly saw that with the United States and the Soviet Union. It was our threat to build the Star Wars defense and the spending that we were started to put behind that in the Reagan years that eventually bankrupted Russia and led to the fall of the Berlin Wall, ultimately. Is that the type of thing that you're talking about, or can it be even more damaging than that?
Well, the point that you didn't raise is that it also put a lot of damage on the American economy, keeping up with that arms race. Let me explain to you basically how that causes a problem. When we built up our military forces, we took a lot of the engineers and scientists in the United States into military research, about a third of them, into focusing on military research and development. Unfortunately, what that meant was they weren't focusing their attention on developing better civilian products and better means of producing. But historically, the success of the United States was based on having technology that was so advanced in civilian areas, such good products and such good ways of producing, such efficient ways of producing, that we could pay high wages and still keep our prices down and make our industries competitive. Over the period of competition with the Soviet Union in military terms, we drew so many of our engineers and scientists into the military research that civilian technology slowed down in the U.S., We lost that technological edge in competitive, commercial, ordinary civilian industry, and we've lost millions of jobs in industry as a result. We can gain those jobs back, but the only way to gain them back is by shifting some of those engineering and scientific resources back into civilian activity so they can revitalize and reinvigorate American competitiveness in civilian industry. And by the way, the problems of competitiveness were so serious in the United States that the Reagan administration recognized them and established a presidential commission on industrial competitiveness to argue, to discover what was the real problem. And they didn't argue that it was high wages in the U.S. They argued, in fact, that high wages were not the problem. The problem was inefficient production because of a lack of civilian technology. And I'm arguing that that lack of civilian technology, that slowing of civilian technology, was a direct result of the focus on military research and development. So this argument that military spending is damaging to the economy is not new with me. In fact, the founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, in the founding work of capitalism, The Wealth of Nations, argues along the same lines that military activities and military preparations are essentially economically unproductive. Neither Smith nor I are saying that you can do without a military, but what we are saying is if you can keep it smaller, that's much better for the economy. And if you can use economic relationships that are properly structured to generate security, you can spend less money and use fewer resources for the military.
All right. My guest is Lloyd Dumas, author of the book, The Peacekeeping Economy. So, Lloyd, you bring up some interesting challenges as you transition from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy. What are some of the practical problems of this transition from military-based security to economic peacekeeping? And I want you to specifically focus on the United States pulling our troops out of Iraq. We've got all of these soldiers that are coming back to the United States. Many of them are going to exit the military. They're going to enter the civilian workforce with 8.6% unemployment. What can be done to ease these soldiers back into the private sector? What should be done?
Well, that's an important issue, and there are two dimensions for this issue. First of all, we've got to stimulate the macroeconomy and make it grow again and reabsorb those people in a growing economy that's based on technology developments that allow us to pay high wages and still stay competitive with other producers in other countries. That's an extremely important thing to do. In the long run, it is possible by reducing the size of our military and transferring the resources into civilian activity to create that kind of stimulus to our economy. It'll produce an industrial renaissance in the United States unlike anything we've seen since the original Industrial Revolution. But in order to do that, it's not a simple matter. It's not as difficult reconnecting the soldiers who come out of Iraq. That's a matter of stimulating the macroeconomy as a whole, which is not simple to do, but it is possible. And the economy is growing now. It is improving slowly. We need to make it improve more rapidly. But the bigger problem will be transferring the engineers and scientists from military research and development into civilian work when we're getting them out of that focus, because we need their attentions in civilian commercial industry. Because military research and development is a very different world. It's not cost sensitive. Cost doesn't matter much to the military, but performance is extremely important. And when you engineer for maximum performance without attention to cost, you get products that in civilian industry would not sell. They'd be too expensive.
Right. Right.
So we have to pay attention to that conversion problem too, but I'm confident we can do it. We can make that transition. And it will be to the long-term benefit of our economy.
I agree, but the question is timing, Lloyd. The big thing is, even if we were to convert all of the scientists today to new products that would be in the private sector, how long would it be before we have the next great idea, the next step in green energy, the next step in healthcare and medicine? How long will it take? And it's always a question of timing. It might take decades before we get those breakthroughs.
Yes, well, it's not going to happen in a year or two, that's for sure. Because science and engineering, unless you're extremely lucky, doesn't proceed like that. It's an incremental process that leads ultimately to breakthroughs which make a huge difference. We didn't get into this problem with a year or two high military spending. We got into it with 50 or 60 years of high military spending. We're not going to get out of it in a year or two either. But we have to start moving in the right direction to rebuild the American economy, because ultimately that's more important than stimulus packages to get things moving in the United States.
My guest is Lloyd Dumas, author of the book, The Peacekeeping Economy, Using Economic Relations to Build a More Peaceful, Prosperous, and Secure World. Lloyd, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, The Peacekeeping Economy?
I want them to take away that there's not only a way to build security with economic relationships, but there's a practical path to moving along that way. In the book, I talk not only about the nature of peacekeeping economic relationships, and we are already partway there. It's not like we're starting from scratch. But I also talk about how to implement these principles on which to build a peacekeeping economy. So the idea is it's something very practical that we can do. In fact, the Europeans have already done. If I can just say for a moment, the European Union was constructed and began in 1952 with something called the European Coal and Steel Community, mm-hmm. which was established in order to build economic relationships to reduce the hostility between France and Germany, who'd been in a few wars with each other over the years.
That's to say the least.
By the 1980s, if you looked at the countries that were in the European Union predecessor, you see France, Germany, Britain, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, the Netherlands. These countries had fought countless wars with each other over the centuries. But now they don't even think about shooting at each other. They have plenty of problems, like the problems with the Eurozone now. They have lots of arguments with each other. They don't even think about shooting because they're so embedded in this meshed web of beneficial economic relationships that they can't see messing it up by starting to make threats against each other militarily.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's a very important lesson.
It is. And Lloyd, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about the book and so forth, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, first of all, there's Yale University Press that published the book, so they'll have some information about the book. I have a homepage at University of Texas at Dallas. And also there's being constructed now a website, which would be called www.thepeacekeepingeconomy.net.
That is great, Lloyd. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.